You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm Andrew Day.
And I'm Connor Eccles.
Each week, we break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news. And we interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack. So, Connor, this week we've got a lot of important topics to get into. We'll be talking about the future of U.S.-Venezuela relations, President Biden considering military strikes on Iran, the funding sources of foreign policy think tanks, why Trump might improve relations with North Korea, the House of Representatives voting to sanction the ICC, and AI characters posing as humans on social media. Then we'll have a more analytical deep dive discussion about Iran and U.S. foreign policy. And after that, we'll be talking to our boss, Robert Wright. I'm not sure exactly what we're going to be talking to him about, to be perfectly honest. I'll probably ask him about his book he's writing on artificial intelligence. I wouldn't be surprised if he has things to say about U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy. And it's always a good bet that he'll talk about the JFK assassination and possibly his new glasses, but we'll see. But now let's do our news bites. What is the first story you want to talk about, Connor?
Yeah, so I want to start off with this think tank report. So basically, a new report from the Quincy Institute found that military contractors and foreign governments have given at least $145 million to major American foreign policy think tanks in just the past 5 years, so since 2019. Now, that data is necessarily limited because this report looks at the top 50 foreign policy think tanks and finds, among other things, that about 19 of them don't disclose anything about their donors at all. These are, of course, the think tanks that house many of the experts that are relied upon by both the government and media for kind of expert comments and advice, and that issue reports that often get coverage. And so this is an interesting little glimpse into the ways that this scene is funded. So one of the biggest foreign government spenders, actually the single biggest foreign government spender, is the United Arab Emirates, which has spent something to the tune of $16 million over the past 5 years. There's other cases of them giving money that are probably bigger than that, but that haven't been reported. And then the biggest recipients of foreign money are, among other ones, the Atlantic Council, the Brookings Institution, which is kind of the most famous center-left think tank, as well as the German Marshall Fund. On the military contractor side, the single biggest donor is weapons maker Northrop Grumman. And the biggest recipients are the Atlantic Council, the Center for a New American Security, which is a sort of center-left, more hawkish, generally considered more hawkish think tank, as well as the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is probably the most respected and kind of centrist-coded think tank in Washington. So some think tankers took umbrage at the report, which they argued will simply be used as a tool to attack scholars whose work is likely not being affected by this funding. But others argued that, you know, in a situation where there's such doubt about experts, these think tanks should really be going above and beyond to demonstrate that they are legitimate. So I'm going to finish this with a quote from Michael Schaefer of Politico, who argued that, quote, hiding behind their researchers' PhDs, as if these were ivory tower philosophy professors who couldn't even find their way to the bursar's office, won't cut it. I'll go back to you, Andrew.
Nice. So Axios reported that President Joe Biden, in a secret meeting last month with his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, reviewed options for attacking Iran's nuclear facilities if Tehran should move toward developing a nuclear weapon. As we know in this week's issue of The Earthling, there appears to be a growing bomb Iran chorus in the Democratic Party, including within the Biden administration. I have a quote from the Axios report. Some of Biden's top aides have argued internally that two trends, the acceleration of Iran's nuclear program and the weakening of Iran and its proxies in their war with Israel, together give Biden an imperative and an opportunity to strike. End quote. So Iran's growing weakness has opened an opportunity for Biden to strike Iran in the view of these White House aides. In The Earthling, we also highlight a very insightful tweet by the reporter Murtaza Hussein, who observed that Iran's growing weakness also means it is more incentivized to acquire nuclear weapons to deter U.S. and Israeli strikes. Israel's successful military operations against Iran's proxy militias across the Middle East amounts to a loss of deterrence for Tehran, as Hussein notes. Matthew Petty of Reason pointed out that in the final years of Donald Trump's administration, there were reports that he was weighing military options for striking Iran, and many Democrats at the time were outraged by the news, with Democratic lawmakers saying that Trump was risking a messy war that his successor would have to clean up. And indeed, Joe Biden himself harshly rebuked then-President Trump for considering a strike on Iran. And to wrap up, I'll just note that Biden didn't greenlight any strikes on Iran. The meeting wasn't intended to solicit a yes or no answer from him on this question. They were just reviewing options. But as we write about in The Earthling, you know, the idea of bombing Iran is, it seems, going more mainstream. And I'll kick it back to you, Connor.
Yeah, so our next news item takes us to Venezuela, where President Nicolas Maduro is expected to be sworn in today for his third term in office, following what the vast majority of observers consider to be a straight-up stolen election last year. His opponent in that election, who was Edmundo Gonzalez, who is a retired diplomat and widely considered the unofficial winner of that election, he's been on a tour this week meeting with foreign leaders, including President Biden here in the United States, as well as the incoming national security advisor to Donald Trump, Representative Michael Waltz. Gonzalez has pledged to return to Venezuela today to take office, but many are doubtful that he's going to do so, and certainly doubtful that he'll do so successfully, since the Maduro regime has a $100,000 bounty on his head and would surely arrest him upon his arrival in the country. The Biden administration is expected to issue new sanctions against members of the Maduro regime today, which gives us a little bit of a preview into what things may look like over the next couple of years as Trump returns to office and will have to face one of the most intractable problems in the Western Hemisphere. So Biden, during his term, has taken real steps to attempt diplomacy with the Maduro regime, but Maduro has, in practice, not responded very well to those overtures. They lifted some sanctions in the lead up to these elections, but put them back in place when Maduro made the decision to prevent them from being free and fair. There are currently some licenses around the sanctions for American oil companies, in part because of the significant loss to the international market with sanctions on Russian oil, but that is currently one of the only ways that the Venezuelan economy is really able to interact with the rest of the world. Now, as for Trump, he took a very hard line in his first term against Venezuela. He approved the idea that Juan Guaido was the legitimate president of Venezuela and refused to engage with the government of Maduro. And he also had a kind of campaign of maximum pressure sanctions that helped to further drive the many economic problems that are facing Venezuela, which are, of course, you know, in part from the sanctions and in part from economic mismanagement. Trump has once again surrounded himself with a very hawkish team when it comes to Venezuela, especially his incoming Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who has long railed against President Maduro. But observers are wondering if Trump may see this as an opportunity to make a deal. He seems to... A big part of the challenge is that, Trump is very focused on, obviously, immigration into the United States. An enormous proportion of the people who are seeking asylum at the southern border today have come from Venezuela. There are at least 6 million people, I believe, that are now refugees from that country and seeking asylum elsewhere. And so Trump may seek, according to some observers, a deal with Maduro that would allow for the repatriation of some of those migrants in exchange for perhaps an easing of sanctions or something else. But that will remain to be seen. So while we wait for more information on that, I'll send it back to you.
Sure. So two recent articles made the case that Donald Trump, when he becomes president, will have an opportunity to improve U.S. foreign policy with respect to North Korea. In the New York Times, geopolitical analyst Dmitry Alperovitch and Cold War historian Sergei Radchenko argued that Donald Trump's personal history with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un could enable the incoming president to peel North Korea away from China and Russia. They write that Trump should capitalize on this history by seeking a lasting peace deal and formal diplomatic relations with North Korea. It now seems like a distant memory or even a strange dream, but in 2019, Trump and Kim did shake hands from opposite sides of the demilitarized zone that separates North and South Korea. And at the time, they both seemed optimistic about the prospects of improved bilateral relations. The second article I alluded to earlier was by Doug Bando of the Cato Institute, writing in Foreign Policy, who makes the case that the recent impeachment and possible ouster of South Korea's hawkish president, Yoon Suk-yeol, will make it easier for Donald Trump to pursue better relations with the North and indeed to help North and South repair their own bilateral relations. Bando doesn't have wildly optimistic expectations of what's possible between the U.S. and North Korea or between North and South in the short term, but he does think the collapse of the current president of South Korea opens up some unexpected opportunities for dialogue. And to wrap up, I'll note, thinking now again of the op-ed by Alperovitch and Radchenko, it's pretty interesting to me that some traditional or even hawkish voices have argued that the U.S. should pursue constructive engagement with North Korea. Josh Rogan of the Washington Post is another example. I tend to think that Iran is the nation in the so-called axis of authoritarians that offers the biggest opportunity for improving relations. But maybe we can talk about that more in our deep dive on Iran and U.S. foreign policy. So for now, I'll just toss it back to you.
Yeah, we should definitely do more on that. But for now, I'm going to talk a little bit about one of the very first acts of the 119th Congress, which was a vote in the House to sanction the International Criminal Court for its act of arrest warrants against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as the former defense minister Yoav Gallant. So the bill, which is widely expected to pass the Senate and become law later this month or perhaps this year, would sanction any individual who helps the International Criminal Court to investigate, arrest, or prosecute either an American official or soldier or one of those protected persons from an allied country that is not a party to the ICC. That sounds kind of complicated, but it boils down to a short list. Which is basically anyone from Egypt, Qatar, Israel, Kuwait, Bahrain, Turkey, or the Philippines. But in this case, it seems to be focused on Israel, which is the only one of those countries that currently is dealing with such a situation. This would impose sanctions on anyone involved in those investigations, including a block on all transactions going through the United States, any property within the United States, as well as entry to the country. The vote showed a pretty significant shift in the partisan dynamics around this type of opposition to the International Criminal Court. 45 Democrats in the House joined about 200 Republicans in the vote to sanction the court. And a few years ago, when Trump sanctioned an ICC prosecutor for starting some investigations into potential American war crimes in Afghanistan, as well as potential Israeli war crimes, within the state of Palestine, which is a member of the court, that drew severe criticism from Democrats. And Biden went on to overturn those sanctions, but it appears that that opposition has become significantly weakened. However, the Knesset a couple of months ago did not help Netanyahu with its decision to ban the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which is the primary UN agency in charge of providing aid within the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. This organization, often referred to as UNRWA, its ban would almost certainly lead, or could possibly lead to something amounting to a full, quote, catastrophe in Gaza, according to the Biden administration. And it will likely strengthen the International Criminal Court prosecutor's argument that the Israeli government is using starvation as a weapon of war in this conflict. So I will send it now back to you, Andrew.
So this last news bit is a fun one, I think, though a bit creepy. This week, Meta deleted the last of 28 AI-powered Facebook and Instagram profiles that it had created over a year ago as an experiment in driving engagement on those platforms. So these profiles were AI characters, non-existent people who had pictures and bios and who posted content about their lives and their views on various social issues, etc. I think it's safe to say that this experiment did not go the way Meta likely hoped that it would. The accounts didn't drive much engagement or even garner much attention until last week when a Financial Times report highlighted Meta's vision for a social media landscape enhanced by AI characters. In the wake of that report, some human users went searching for the already existing AI characters and they were creeped out by what they found. We give one example of an AI character who described herself in her bio as a proud Black queer mama of two and truth teller. I think the first part of that's going to get the most attention, but the truth teller part was like the weirdest, creepiest part. And that AI character recently recounted that she had led a charitable coat drive. She even shared an AI-generated image of the non-event. You can go to the Earthling and see the picture of boxes full of coats, presumably on their way to homeless AI characters living on the streets. To be fair, Meta did label these accounts as AI. Like if you went to their main profile page, you could see that they were AIs managed by Meta, is what I think the label said. But you easily could have mistaken their posts as coming from real human users. One thing we found noteworthy about this story is just Meta's interest in going this direction, you know, in having AI characters who are optimized to increase user engagement. One can imagine a world in which people at tech companies were instead thinking about how to ensure that only real humans are posting content on social media and that these real humans have some guarantee when they engage with accounts that they're interacting with real people. But we seem to be headed in the opposite direction, or at least Meta is. So, Connor, I think it's now time for our deep dive on Iran and U.S. foreign policy. Earlier, I discussed the recent Axios report that Biden had reviewed military options for striking Iran's nuclear facilities. I have some thoughts on the whole situation and on, you know, Iran policy generally. But first, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this topic today.
Yeah, I think what really stands out to me here is the extent to which this has gone bipartisan. I think that we, after a really long time of Democrats being committed to resolving this kind of crisis with the Iranian regime through diplomacy, there's now a focus on potential military solutions that, I mean, you know, isn't without new evidence, right? There is a significant amount of new evidence over the past year and just changed circumstances that the U.S. or Israel working together may have a better chance of destroying Iran's nuclear weapons facilities, or not non-existent nuclear weapons facilities as of now, but currently existing nuclear enrichment facilities. And I think that's going to be a much greater temptation in kind of the coming months and years, regardless of what happens. So there's that kind of change on the ground. But the ideological change has been really striking, because, you know, there are many reasons to not bomb Iran, among them that it would encourage Iran to start moving towards a nuclear weapon. And it's not at all clear that the United States or Israel or any combination of states could act fast enough to prevent Iran from creating some sort of bomb and reestablishing its deterrent in a way that I think a lot of people would find very concerning and potentially destabilizing, setting aside people who find nuclear weapons to be a more stabilizing force in international politics. So I think what really stands out to me is just that there's been this kind of slow. It's similar to the ICC story I was talking about, where like, Over the past year and a half, especially since October 7th, and potentially because of Biden's leadership on this issue and a somewhat more hawkish direction, there's been a real shift towards a willingness to use military force in the Middle East again, and I find it concerning, I guess.
Yeah, it is, and it's notable that shift is taking place at the same time that Iran has a very reform-oriented, moderate new president who is clearly signaling, you know, his desire for his administration to, you know, pursue constructive engagement with the U.S. and with the West generally. I mean, I think one reason for this shift within the Democratic Party is just led by the different presidents of Obama and Biden. You know, Obama took a big political risk when he pursued the Iran nuclear deal. And, you know, Democrats kind of went along with it and it worked. And then President Biden obviously hasn't done that. You know, he hasn't done much by way of trying to revive the Iran nuclear deal. So I think that that's a big part of it. One thing that I'd want to point out is, you know, the conclusion that Iran wants to develop nuclear weapons is basically, it's a rationalist inference. You know, people can see that Iran is vulnerable. They're surrounded by U.S. military power. Their neighbors to the east and to the west were invaded and occupied by the U.S. during the war on terrorism. So even though U.S. intelligence agencies say they don't believe Iran is actively pursuing a nuclear weapons capability, or at least they don't have evidence of that, they say, it stands to reason that Iran would want nuclear weapons to deter its more powerful adversaries, which is kind of funny because, you know, foreign policy analysts tend to depict Iran as a kind of pathological actor led by these mad mullahs who operate according to like a theological logic rather than a geopolitical one, when really it's kind of the opposite. It's like, you know, a normal geopolitical actor in their situation probably would want nuclear weapons capability. But Iran, unless, correct me if I'm wrong, but their leadership has this idea that Islam forbids nuclear weapons, right? So if anything, their like theological commitments could be kind of helping us out here. You know, I do tend to think that Iran would want to get a nuclear weapons capability. It's just for them, you know, if they could push a button and magically have a nuclear weapon, I think they would do that. The dicey part for them is the bid to attain one, to develop the capability. It takes time, and the U.S. and Israeli intelligence services are so good that they'll be privy to what Iran is up to, and they probably wouldn't let that happen. So that's kind of the bind that Iran is in, as I see it.
Yeah. I think the counter argument to that kind of rational path to Iran kind of needing a nuclear weapon or seeing it as necessary for its security, this has changed a little bit in the past year, again, as everything has, but I've seen the argument made, and I think it's somewhat persuasive that Iran gets more by being on the verge of getting a nuclear weapon than it would necessarily from getting a nuclear weapon, right? It allows it to have the threat of moving in that direction and thus to potentially make deals. If we foreclose the possibility of a deal, then that pathway becomes unattractive. There is simply no incentive for them to not move towards a nuclear weapon. But if there is a possibility of a deal, then they've actually got plenty of reasons to not want to go in that direction because they've got the example of North Korea to look at, right? Like, North Korea has been under even more strangling sanctions than Iran for even longer. And I really would expect something very similar to happen because the international community is very opposed to nuclear proliferation and has shown that time and time again at the United Nations and elsewhere. So I think if Iran did end up moving towards a nuclear weapon, it could make it safe in a limited sense, but it would surely complicate its relations with China. It would surely complicate its relations with many important states within the UN system. And so there is that argument against it. But again, I think the most important thing there is kind of what I started with, which is that if we foreclose the path to diplomacy, then we are only left with the path to a nuclear weapon. There just isn't another logical way for Iran to guarantee its national security interests.
Yeah, and if Iran is actually thinking of their incentives in the way that you just laid out, where they get more from being on the verge of a nuclear weapon than they would if they actually acquired one, you know, that calculus can change. You know, I don't know if this Axios report on Biden reviewing military options for striking Iran, I don't know if it was leaked intentionally by someone who had like specific motives in leaking it, you know, maybe to signal to Iran that, you know, you better not pursue a nuclear weapon in the last few weeks of the Biden administration. But they need to be aware that the ultimate effect of such threats of strikes, you know, could have the opposite effect on Iran's calculations. You know, the more likely we make it seem that a strike is going to happen, the more they may want a nuclear weapon. I mean, you mentioned North Korea. I know that during the Trump administration, there was some talk of how to handle North Korea and whether military options would be viable. And Steve Bannon, who was, I don't remember what his role is in the Trump administration. I think he was, it was like a newly created role, like chief strategist or something. Is that right? And he was the campaign manager of Trump's victorious 2016 campaign. But Bannon said something like, well, we can't do that. You know, they've got us. Like they have nuclear weapons. They have a way to deliver the payload and perhaps even to reach the United States. So that option is off the table. And I would have to think that Iran must think that that is an attractive option. You know, they're already under sanctions, as you mentioned. Maybe they're not as crippling as what North Korea is under, but they're also under a growing threat of strikes from the U.S. and Israel, from much more powerful adversaries, which is why I think they probably want to get a nuclear weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I want to think a little bit too about, you know, you were talking about North Korea earlier and the peeling off potentially of North Korea from Russia and China. I think I do like that this is becoming more of an argument that we're seeing in the mainstream. I think that there's been this sort of growing narrative of an axis of autocracies or a new axis of evil or things like that. Which in my, and you know, that's Iran, China, North Korea, Russia, right? That's usually who you've been seeing in those arguments. And that really risks being a self-fulfilling prophecy from an American point of view or from a Western point of view in general. If you insist that all of these states are already allied and you don't spend any time trying to pull them apart, then yes, they will probably continue to cooperate more and more closely and they'll continue to do this. But the idea of, you know, potentially striking deals with North Korea, striking deals with Iran, probably North Korea, it might want to be first in the sense that North Korea poses the greatest threat to the United States today, right? So that might be the highest priority from that perspective. I agree that Iran is probably the state most likely of the four that we've mentioned to actually potentially kind of ease relations with the U.S. and the one that's most interested in it from a political point of view. But I guess just generally, I applaud this sort of any effort to undermine the narrative that America's, you know, adversaries or whatever you want to call them are already part of an alliance that is sort of immutable and unstoppable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's still kind of weird to me that hawkish voices tend to be more prone to wanting engagement with North Korea than Iran, because that country is just so bizarre and kind of unpredictable. And its leadership is much more hostile in its rhetoric. I mean, obviously, like the Ayatollah and stuff, has said hostile stuff about the West and the U.S. and Israel. But some of the stuff coming out of North Korea is just like crazy. Whereas Iran's new president is like, as I said earlier, clearly signaling he wants diplomacy. You have to figure that America's relationship with Israel plays a big role in why the foreign policy establishment and the United States is so hostile to Iran and to the possibility of diplomatic engagement with Iran. And also just maybe the memory of like the hostage situation from way back before you and I were born, that seems to have played a big role in how people interpret this country as like this country that kind of stood up to the U.S. and we have to like never let them forget it or benefit from it.
Well, it's funny because you were talking about like the revolutionary moment, the like kind of argument that a lot of people have that Iran is sort of a revolutionary state, acts in revolutionary ways. In a lot of ways, it was really only through the hostage crisis and up until the start of the Iran-Iraq war that they did act that way in any way, shape or form. Right. Like, it's true that Iranian influence led to some serious problems within Saudi Arabia in 1979. It's true that end of 1979. And it's true that you had kind of more issues throughout the region, but they haven't really been a revolutionary state for almost like 40 years now. They've been an established regime that is mostly acting to deter what it views as threats to itself rather than expanding its like ideological influence, which is honestly pretty limited. There just aren't a lot of groups or states out there that are following their lead in any meaningful way.
Yeah, Iran's government tends to be pretty pragmatic and patient. You know, they don't, they clearly put a lot of thought into how they should respond to like tensions with the U.S. and you know, their neighborhood. I think that's all I have to say about the Iran situation. Do you have anything else, or should we go ahead and jump on with Bob and talk to him?
No, let's go ahead and bring Bob on.
Bob, welcome aboard.
Thank you. Thank you. How's the first part of your show? Oh, nice of you to ask. I'm doing fine, actually.
That's good. I think Connor's doing fine, too. I asked
Connor's
him
always
doing
fine.
Said,
Connor's
fine.
Always doing fine.
I'm yes. too upbeat. Connor... Bob's worried that I'm too upbeat, that I'm bringing too much of a sunny disposition to this podcast.
Connor is really? Irish. Connor has a lot of Irish in him. I have a lot of Scottish. And you know the story about the Scottish guy. You say to him, hey, nice day. And he says, just wait. That's me. That's not Connor.
Bob, do you want to tell the people why you're joining the chat today?
Well, first of all, it's the moment they've been waiting for, right? I'm like a big draw, right?
Of course.
You would agree. I'm a big draw on the internet. Like there's
They usually complain when you're not here, so it's good to have you on.
Oh, there's an outcry. There's a global outcry in my experience. First of all, I've been here before occasionally. Even though it's your show, I generally start by saying, how did the first part of the show go? And Connor does say, great. And Andrew sits there silently because he's too tactful to tell me the truth. And so we're done with that part. But also, this is kind of a big week because for people who read the Non-Zero newsletter, as those people know, probably by about now. The Friday edition is coming out about time it's being posted. It's called The Earthling. And although normally that is the product of, you know, a lot of work by a lot of people, but certainly including me and my obsessive attention to it, the next 6 weeks, Connor's going to be liberated from the tyranny of Bob and will be a kind of a guest editor. And he's visibly excited. Look at Connor, Andrew.
I think the title should be acting editor-in-chief. That sounds cooler. It sounds cooler than editor-in-chief. It's like you usurped the title somehow, mysteriously.
It's a peaceful transfer.
Which could still happen. So I think that was the first phrase I threw out. And I think guest editor came from Connor. It's kind of the same... Kind of the same thing. I could get into details. But anyway, congratulations, Connor. It must feel good breathing down your throat as I sit here or breathing down your neck.
Yeah, that's the phrase.
Or your throat.
That part of our relationship is
Connor, that part of our relationship is also over. I wanted to bring you that news.
But, listeners should know that Bob and I have actually never met in person. So these are lies. These are lies that are being spread.
That is a weird fact. I mean,
that is a fun fact.
We have had God knows how many hours of conversation and never met in person. Andrew, I did meet in person.
That's right.
You saw me parallel park under pressure.
Yeah, you're taller than I thought. You're a tall
People
guy.
People say that. People say yeah. that.
Well, you did parallel park. You did very pressure. Well, even though we had cars behind us. So.
Did I sweat? No, I thrive on pressure. So anyway, I guess we promised in the print in the newsletter to explain like why this is happening and why it actually augurs well for the newsletter. Not that anyone would have doubted you're becoming guest editor augurs anything other than well, Connor, but. Explain how some kind of long-term implications as I see them. But first, the short-term motivation. So as many people know by now, I'm writing a book on artificial intelligence. As they may or may not know, the publisher, Simon & Schuster, has announced a pub date. In fact, you can go to Amazon and search for my name and The God Test. And see, not the book per se, because that isn't quite finished, but the jacket and a few words about it. And so, yeah, now I have to actually finish the book, like pronto. I mean, I've done a lot of it and sent it in, and they're happy with it. But I've got to finish.
So there is a finalized jacket now. Is that right?
Well, the in principle, these things could always change, but yeah, there is.
Looks cool. I've seen this one. Yeah.
Well, you haven't seen that exact one. You guys were part of the vetting process, I think, but yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. So anyway, I gotta focus and finish this, and hence the need to step away somewhat. Two things I'd say about kind of long-term implications. First of all, the work I'm doing on the book in the meanwhile will be reflected in the newsletter, probably in a couple of senses. First of all, in the long run, paid subscribers are going to have access to some of the book itself. When and how that happens is yet to be determined, because it has to be coordinated with my publisher. If they say, wait, spring is 2 months too soon to start doing that, I will respect their view. But one way or the other, you know, some of the work will show up in the newsletter. And also, in the meanwhile, I'm going to be showing up maybe a little more in video than I used to for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think I'm going to make more frequent appearances on this show, The Weekend Show, partly just to, I guess, I think, you know, when you don't have when you're used to having a way to express yourself, like a newsletter or something, and suddenly that's not there, like these things build up that you feel you have to say somewhere. And so I will show up a little more often. At the same time, I don't want to spend a ton of time formulating opinions during these 6 weeks about things not related to AI. So maybe a disproportionate number of the things I say when I show up will be about AI. Some of my regular podcasts will be. In fact, as it happens, this next week I'm doing one with Tim Lee on AI, who writes a newsletter on AI. And so in various ways, what I'm doing will show up in non-zero land, the work I'm doing over the next 6 weeks, including, I think, when we get around to discussing stuff other than this, there are items in the newsletter that are, I gather, about AI. I mean, I haven't seen the bulk of the newsletter. I have seen the short in brief items, and I see that one or two of them are AI related. Oh, I know what I want to say. But first of all, you know, I hate it when people talk for a super long time. So why don't you guys interject stuff? I have one more thing to say about this.
Okay. Yeah, dive in. I'm interrupting you, Bob. This is an interruption. Is there any other? Andrew, do you have a better one?
Maybe it's a good, did we want to talk about the fact that we're hiring at the moment? That's been announced in the newsletter. I don't know if we've said that here.
We should, yes. And I want to, there's three positions, kind of full-time person with background in, initially it said print journalism, by which I just meant writing. Connor pointed out that to probably most people, print connotes ink on paper. And I didn't mean you have to have worked at a place that publishes in the form of anything other than electrons. That's fine. But anyway, full-time position of that kind. And if people want details, they can go to the latest Earthling, the final in brief item, those short items at the top, links to the full job description for all jobs. And the other thing we mentioned is kind of a halftime job, mainly about social media. And then there may be another part-time job that is undefined, because there will only be that job if we hear from somebody who says, here's what I think needs doing for you. and I'm the person to do it, and it makes sense. So this is probably going to be somebody fairly familiar with non-zero and the array of, you know, products, the podcast, the Earthling and the other forms the newsletter can take. Yeah, what else? Is there anything else I should say about that?
No, I mean, one thing I would say on the staff writer position is that obviously we do a lot of coverage of foreign policy here, and we encourage people with a foreign policy background to apply. But, you know, we're also very much interested in people that cover some of the other sort of topics of interest for us. So that could be AI, that could be, say, cognitive biases, political tribalism. You know, we definitely are interested in all kinds of content there. So don't hesitate to apply if you feel like you don't have the foreign policy background.
Absolutely. You know, we've traditionally focused a lot on foreign policy. There will continue to be a lot of that. But the idea is we want to be expanding our range of content. So and quantity of content. So we could, over the next year, produce without reducing the like absolute amount of foreign policy stuff, produce a lot more stuff about other issues that are traditionally, you know, just part of our mission and our worldview. Those certainly include the problem we commonly call psychology of tribalism, which is manifest both in domestic political polarization, international conflict, as well as other ways, and what you do about it, and so on. And, you know, and also a lot of transnational policy issues that don't get enough attention in foreign policy circles to always be thought of as foreign policy issues, even if they are. So, yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to say about the, I think, a virtue of doing this 6-week thing is I just need to get better at keeping my hands off of things a little more, because that it's just an inherent part of making an operation bigger. First of all, just delegating more and specifically, I think it free, you know, it can free me to focus on expansion and new things we're doing and other things we're doing. And in fact, I've already had a phone call this week, because I wasn't in a time when normally I would have been thinking about the Earthling and working on it, with somebody about some initiatives that aren't journalistic, but could help us out. They're more on the technical side. So I think, you know, and I, you guys are too tactful to, step in and note that you both think I'm a little too obsessive in my focus on.
You're data. Always breathing down our throats, Bob. It's getting out of hand.
You know, I had been wondering, should I just like let that go by the first time rather than making a joke about it?
Andrew's a thing.
Andrew's making sure that this becomes an actual meme, like a controversy about Bob. Oh, what is it about? The people who work for him are a lot younger than him. Interesting. What's going on there? So thank you, Andrew.
No problem.
Yeah.
If we're done with the housekeeping stuff, I'm kind of thinking of you as our guest expert this week. We always interview an expert, and your expertise is in AI. We have a few. I mean, you know, you're writing a book on AI, and we have some AI items. One of them I've already talked about. It's this thing about how Meta deleted the last of their AI character accounts on Facebook and Instagram. I think we talked in an editorial meeting about that item. And then I guess there are a couple in briefs that also touch on the topic of AI. Right. Is there anything you want to say about AI updates this week, either related to the Earthling or not?
Well, there are a couple of AI things. I mean, first of all, there's this piece about this apparently fake think tank whose content is generated by bots. This was uncovered by DropSite. That's a new journalistic outlet.
Another Substack outlet. So
yeah, with some estimable people behind it. But I actually looked at this. So what this is it's a think tank called, first of all, they spelled center in the British way,
yeah,
which, so it's apparently an actual, like, Pakistani, pro-Pakistan propaganda thing. The content is actually generated by AIs. The so-called staffers, whose so-called pictures are on the site, are actually apparently fake. They don't exist. It's called the Beltway Grid Policy Center, CENTRE. Memo to bots. We don't spell it that way in America, but whatever. Maybe this was it. It could be
It gives it a kind of prestigious air.
It does.
You know?
It may be intentional. And the Beltway Grid thing is kind of, you know, there is a tendency now to depart from the traditional kind of names. There's like the Silverado Policy Accelerator that Dmitry
Alperovich
does. He's mentioned in another item. But what were you going to say, Connor?
Well, I was going to say what stuck out to me was that, like, they actually got cited a few times in media. I think it's kind of... This Yahoo is kind News. Of a warning, I guess, to media. It's, you had Yahoo News, you had Morningstar, major financial news outlet, and then also Middle East Eye, all of which produce much reputable content. I'm not saying that they don't, but this is a real oversight. If you go to the website, to be honest, people should have known.
Yeah, look, I went there, and I want to read a sentence, okay? So the title of this, like, kind of piece they published on the think tank site is Media Representation of Israel-Palestine Conflict, a Comparative Analysis. Here's a sentence. It's actually not a sentence, but it's supposed to be a sentence. While Palestinian viewpoints do get some coverage at times in these aspects, semicolon, interestingly, then they are often depicted more as victims, period, associated with violence than, this is a new sentence, associated with violence than highlighting their agency and political goals. The language choices in media tend to show a favoritism towards Israel by using terms such as, quote, killings, and by the way, there were no commas in the preceding stretch. It read like that. Using terms such as, quote, killings instead of assassination. Here's my favorite parts. And, quote, militants instead of freedom fighters. Listen, here's a little memo to the bots. If you want to change the terminology that, say, the New York Times uses, I would say, or in the mainstream media, like, it's one thing to hope that you'll phase out terrorists in favor of militants. But if you're waiting for the day when the New York Times calls Hamas militants, quote, freedom fighters, I think you really need to acquaint yourself more thoroughly with the media landscape.
Yeah. Yeah. Like martyrs in the path of God is just, yeah,
that's what I would hope would enter the Times style book. Yeah. Yes.
Why was the writing so bad? I mean, there's no chatbot. That's
no, I mean, right? That's the other thing. Use Claude. Yeah. Don't use X. Use Claude.
Was the work cited by Yahoo News, et cetera? Did it seem reasonable? And
well, so it got picked up. They kind of had this like wire essentially of stories that would come out of analysis, and that's what got picked up by Yahoo News. As far as I can tell, the only one where like a journalist cited them in a reported piece was Middle East Eye. But it was a piece that was shared according to their website like a couple thousand times, right? Which is yeah, I mean, this is definitely it's an interesting way to see how you can use AI even in imperfect ways to spread propaganda, right? Because editors are busy, journalists are busy, they're putting out a lot of stories a day. These types of oversights, especially with fact-checking departments not existing at the vast majority of places, these can happen. So this is probably not the last of these that we're going to see.
Oh, no, I know. And you know, the other item, it's such a blurry line. It's like, what is the difference between somebody who relies very heavily on an LLM to produce content and just something that's bot driven. I mean, if some human gives it a read, is it no longer bot driven? And look, I should say another thing I need to think about now that I'm gonna have maybe a little more time is, you know, how exactly we use AI, because there are ways to use it. I think, you know, what we have to commit to is that we'll always be transparent. And, you know, but there's a lot of this stuff. I mean, the whole, you know, I mean, part of the thesis of my book is this is going to be an earthquake. And I don't think people really understand yet. And that's something you hear among AI people. And I've said it on a podcast to one of these AI people a time or two probably, and we've agreed it's like people don't get it yet. This is going to be absolutely, and the time frame is a little unclear. And you know, as somebody's going to publish a book, you wonder, like, you know, August maybe sooner than is optimal given how this will play out. It may be another year or two before everybody goes, oh shit. But I think there's going to be an oh shit moment. And the truth is that by and large, organizations, journalistic and otherwise, that just make no use of this stuff whatsoever are going to, I think, for the most part, fall by the wayside. It's going to be hard to compete. That doesn't mean they're writing your stuff. There are a lot of ways to use it. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm curious if you, we have an item, again, Andrew said that we've already talked about this, but it talks about these like kind of AI-driven profiles that Meta had created on Instagram and Facebook. This kind of initial experiment in encouraging engagement with bots failed, but I'm curious to get your take on how like AI bots becoming a more substantial part of social media could affect that experience.
Yeah, I don't know how. I mean,
this was a free preview of
Non-Zero World.
To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.